My name is Paul Bosch, and this session is Worship, Where Are the Invariables? But I brought along some copies of LBW, and I want to sing a hymn first, which was my custom as a teacher in a seminary, to sing a hymn before every time the class gathered. So let me have you turn to 208. This is a little preview of Wednesday night. We're going to sing this hymn on Wednesday night, and you'll be guinea pigs here and a kind of a preview choir. You may not know this hymn, Du Lebensbrot, Herr Jesu Christ, wonderful German chorale, tuned from the, 17th century, and text from the 17th century, as you will see, particularly in verse 4. But let us sing this wonderful chorale. You do not know it, probably, but I will sing it loud, and you join along with me. 208, share your book. I only have enough for every other person.
There's the bell.
What's that?
The bell rang.
The bell rang. Oh, thank you. Note that a chorale melody typically has A, A, B, and then either A or A prime or B or C. In other words, the first line, Lord Jesus Christ, you have prepared this feast for my salvation, the same melody is repeated the second line, your very body and your blood thus at your invitation. Then with weary heart by sin oppressed, that's a little different. I come to you for needed rest, that's a little different. And then a little kind of a review of some of the musical themes of the first line and the second line here in the last line. Wonderful hymn and a great text. Let's sing 1 and 4, okay? We won't sing them all. It goes like this. You sing along with me when you catch on. Lord Jesus Christ, you have prepared this feast for my salvation. Your very body and your blood thus at your invitation. With weary heart by sin oppressed, I come to you. At stanza 4, very 17th century orthodoxy here. Unaided reason cannot see what eager faith embraces, but this consoling supper, Lord, each restless doubt. Telling somebody a minute ago, I'm a Luddite. You know what a Luddite is? Somebody who doesn't like technology. From Ned Ludd in the 17th century England, who went around smashing weaving machines. Weaving up until that time was all done by home weavers. But then weaving machines came in and they had factories and so on. And Ned Ludd, I've heard that he's a mythical figure. But anyhow, they went around with sledgehammers and smashed weaving machines because they thought they would be put out of work. So a Luddite is somebody who doesn't like technology. And I have problems with technology. Anyhow, let me tell you about a wedding that I presided at a couple of years ago. I was asked to marry to preside at the wedding, to officiate at the wedding of our mayor's daughter. And our mayor was a woman, as a matter of fact, and her husband, we got to know them, and her daughter, and she asked me if I would officiate at her wedding. So it was to be an outdoor wedding in the middle of the summer, and the crowd was gathered. They had a tent for the reception, but the wedding itself was to be under this wonderful rose arbor. Well, 5 minutes before the wedding, a great big thunderhead cloud came overhead, and lightning began to play back and forth, and thunder. And the father of the bride came over to me. I had my clerical collar on. And the father of the bride came over to me, and he said, "With your connections, can you do something about this?" And I said, "Gee, I'd like to help you, Glenn, but I'm only in sales. I'm not in management." It's not original with me, but I thought it was a funny joke, and I used it with him. Then I read John Updike. Any of you fans of John Updike? Roger's version, have you read Roger's version? Wonderful story about a parish pastor who is now a seminary professor. And at one place in the book, he's talking with his niece, and his niece says, well, Uncle Roger, you're really a salesman, aren't you? You're a salesman for religion. And he says, well, I used to be in sales when I was in the parish, but he says, now that I teach in seminary, I'm in quality control. And I kind of like that, too. So, as a matter of fact, I would invite you to think of our time this evening in terms of quality control. That is to say, this is the shop talk of professionals, pastors, and lay people who are interested in the worship life of the church. And so, you know, it's not the kind of thing you would put in a sermon necessarily, but it's shop talk. We're talking here now, and I want to leave the last 10 minutes at least for dialogue, and if you want to interrupt me anywhere along the line, feel free to do that. Anyhow, I'm here to tell you that you are living in a remarkable time. You are living in a time of ecumenical agreement about what worship is, what Christian worship is, and how Christian worship ought to be done. And this is an agreement, a consensus, a gathering of opinion that is unprecedented since before the Reformation. I mean, not since before the Reformation has there been such agreement as to what Christian worship is all about and how it might best be done. And I hold up to you as a document, as a matter of fact, I could flash both of these, this little document called Baptism, Eucharist, and Ministry. Have some of you seen that? That's only a couple of years old now, and our own Bill Lazarus, Bishop of Metropolitan New York City, now retired, but he had a big hand in the preparation of this document, and the documents also of the Second Vatican Council of the Roman Catholic Church. Those two documents, the document from that comes out of the study of the liturgy from the Second Vatican Council, and this document, Baptism, Eucharist, and Ministry, have made all the difference. And you find Christian churches across a wide spectrum, Christian theologians, Christian pastors, Christian lay people, asking the same questions and coming up with the same answers. So, for instance, this book is the result of 40 years, I think it is, of study. Over 100 theologians met in Lima, Peru in January 82 and recommended unanimously to transmit this agreed statement, the so-called Lima text, from the town in Peru where they met, for the common study and official response of the churches. They represented virtually all of the major church traditions: Eastern Orthodox, Oriental Orthodox, Roman Catholic, Old Catholic, Lutheran, Anglican, Reformed, Methodist, United, Disciples, Baptist, Adventist, and Pentecostal. I mean, can you imagine that? Agreement as to what baptism is all about, Holy Communion is all about, ministry is all about. And as I say, we have not had this kind of a thing since before the Reformation. Now, there's wide agreement, as I say, but there's also some naysayers. In other words, I'm not going to say that it's altogether unanimous, because there are at least three different voices that you can find out there in your parish, maybe, and certainly out there in the world, that represent, a contra voice, that is, a voice against this kind of agreement. One would be the conservatives, for instance, within Roman Catholicism. And Cardinal Ratzinger, for instance, you know that name. He is charged by the Vatican with the defense of the faith. And he's not so sure about the reforms of Vatican II. And as a matter of fact, he says we ought to reform some of those reforms. And where in Vatican II, the Second Vatican Council, the altar came out from the wall and the priest was now behind the altar facing the people, Cardinal Ratzinger says, no, we should push the altar back against the wall again. And you suppose that the present pope has, or Cardinal Ratzinger has the present pope's ear. I would guess that the present pope, too, is a little uncertain, if not, shall I say, negative, about some of the things that might appear in this book. But by and large, I would say the people I read, the books across the board, and the Christian denominations, are coming up with these statements that I hope to lay upon you in the next 5 days. This is just the first of 4 sessions that I have with you. Tomorrow, Wednesday, I skip Thursday and Friday, but I'll meet again on Saturday if you're here. So the conservatives within Roman Catholicism would be one voice that is not part of this consensus. There's a second voice that would be not part of this consensus, and that would be the conservatives, the liturgical conservatives, that is to say, in some of the other Christian denominations. I'm thinking, for instance, of an outfit called the Prayer Book Society among Anglicans, Episcopalians. There is a group over in England, and some of them are on this side of the ocean as well, who think we ought to stick with the old Book of Common Prayer, and these and thous, and you know, that kind of language. Vatican II did away with all of that, and the reforms that this document represent did away with that kind of language. But there are still people who say, gee, we ought to stick with the old thee, thou kind of talk. And the old Book of Common Prayer, we don't want to give that up. There's a third group, and that is the so-called church growth movement. Some of you may have bumped up against the church growth movement. Comes out of Southern California, Fullerton. Robert Schuller is one of the leading lights in that movement. And it has a liturgical, a worship manifestation, you might say, in what is called entertainment evangelism. And we're going to talk about that more specifically tomorrow. But I want to flag for you today the fact that the church growth people and the entertainment evangelism people would not buy into this. Incidentally, they have this book at the bookstore if you want to pick it up, and they have my little book at the bookstore too. I'm one of 3 authors of this little book called What is Contemporary Worship? And you might want to pick that up before you go. Okay, so there are dissenting voices. There are voices, there are people in all of the churches who do not agree with this consensus. But I'm here to tell you, this is a wide-ranging consensus. It's been developing over 40 years, 50 years, a long, long time. And it has some very practical things to say, as well as some theoretical stuff to say. And we're going to take up both practical and theoretical here in these sessions, including today. And I hope it will be interesting and enlightening to you. Let me flag right from the beginning that my subject is worship, and as I say, in a sense, it's kind of the shop talk about worship. It's not the kind of thing that you would talk on the street corner necessarily with anybody. And I want to make it clear that it's not a matter of right versus wrong, that this is the right way to worship and that's a wrong way. But I think we can say this or that is faithful to this ecumenical consensus, which you can find in this document and in the documents of Vatican II, or maybe it's not faithful. And so I would prefer to talk in those terms rather than terms right and wrong. There are a lot of different ways to worship. And there are a lot of different ways to worship within this consensus. But spontaneously and confidently commit myself to the consensus that I'm going to lay out to you. And I think it's a good consensus, and I think it's gospel-centered and Bible-centered, and I think it works for the health of the church and for the health of Christian people. But I wouldn't want to say, you know, this is right and this is wrong. I would rather say, well, you bring that matter up, that's really not what the consensus is talking about. And you might want to rethink that. So that brings me to another little footnote, and that is this. Whenever you hear a presentation like this, whenever you go into a new church that you haven't been to before, whenever you open up a new hymn book, and whenever you go to a new unfamiliar type of church building and join in their worship, whenever that happens, you are invited, I'd like you to think of it this way, you are invited to think your piety, a friend of mine says, your piety is like your hemoglobin. he had a couple of tests the other day, he said, and he discovered he had hemoglobin. He didn't know he had hemoglobin. But apparently, oh, there I go again. Lord have mercy. What am I doing to you?
Yeah.
You can hear me.
I lost you for a while.
Yeah, well, I dropped this unit again. I'm going to hold it in my hand. Maybe that'll prevent the problem.
Okay.
My friend, as I say, didn't know he had hemoglobin, but sure enough, he does. Everybody does. And I would say everybody has a piety or a spirituality or a way at coming at life, a way at relating yourself to God and relating yourself to the creation and to your fellow creatures, your brothers and sisters. All that is piety. And when this new book, for instance, was published, new, 1979 now, I mean, it's not all that new. But when this book was published, it represented a challenge to people's piety who were familiar with the Red Book, let's say, or from some other book. And there were some significant changes in this book over against the Red Book. And those changes, again, invite you to think about your own relationship to God, your own relationship to one another, your own relationship to the creation. So it's not a matter of small consequence. When you fool around with people's piety, you're fooling around with heavy stuff. And I don't think this book does that. It wants to change people's piety, yes. It wants to deepen and strengthen people's piety, but it doesn't want to upset the apple cart or just offend for the sake of offending. And I hope you don't take our sessions together here in those terms, but rather in terms of deepening and widening and so on. Okay, let us ask this question. Where does this new ecumenical consensus come from? Ecumenical consensus in worship. I should say that you'll find a lot of consensus these days, maybe not quite as stirring as the consensus in worship, but you can find a lot of consensus in what I call the four C's: creed, code, cult, and constitution. In other words, in all of these areas, there's a wide agreement among Christians these days. There's a lot of disagreement as well. There's a lot of dissent, but there's also a lot of agreement about creed, that is what Christians believe, theological statements like this baptism, Eucharist, and ministry, code, that's ethics, behavior, how Christian people ought to live in the world, a lot of agreement there. Cult, that's a fancy word for worship, liturgy, and there's a lot of agreement there, and that's what we're studying in these sessions, these four sessions this week. And even, did I spell that right? Constitution, yeah. That is to say church structures, church organization. And I would argue, and I think others would agree with me, that in every generation, the Christian church has to do this homework over again. So in every generation, there will be a new translation of the Bible. In every generation, there will be a new hymn book. So just get ready for it. And this is, you know, halfway through its life. It's in a midlife crisis, as somebody says. But what do you do in a midlife crisis? You don't divorce your wife and run off with the secretary. You stick with it and you try to find new depths and so on. And that's the whole point of this book, too, I would say. Let us try to find new depths and new meanings and new wonderful stuff in there that a lot of people don't know anything about. But it's terrific. Okay, where does this ecumenical consensus come from in worship? We're talking chiefly about the third C there, creed and code. Walt Bowman and others are talking about those matters. Are we talking about Yeah, we're talking about Constitution tonight, aren't we, in the forum? Isn't that tonight? That is to say, church. What do I want my church to look like? What do I want my church to be? So we'll get into matters of structure there. But in these sessions, we're talking about the third thing on that list, that is to say, cult, which is a fancy word for worship. And the ecumenical consensus about worship that I'm talking about comes to us from cultural anthropology today. And even, here's another big word for you, phenomenology. Phenomenology means phenomena, you know, what's going on out there. phenomenology. And phenomenology, or cultural anthropology, is the study of how people worship. And so you find books being written and learned discussions and conferences being held about, let us say, Native American spirituality and Native American worship, or the worship of the ancient Druids or whatever. I mean, that is a big field these days, cultural anthropology as it relates to worship, and so-called ritual studies. We're going to talk more about that tomorrow. But let me just flag for you today the fact that that is where the excitement is these days in worship. Cultural anthropology or phenomenology. I come from Wilfrid Laurier University. I'm the faculty of the Religion and Culture Department of that university. It's a fellow named Ron Grimes. Some of you may know that name. He is a worldwide authority, believe it or not, on ritual studies. And he's written a book, a couple of books, about ritual studies. And ritual studies is where the action is these days in worship, including Christian worship, because these people, the phenomenologists and the cultural anthropologists, have showed us that Christian worship is like a lot of other worship. It's got some significant differences too, but there are a lot of similarities with the ways other people worship. And that has led people into some exciting new discoveries, and some of this, this document, Baptism, Eucharist, and Ministry, is informed, you might say, by those studies. Significantly, it's not from history, it's not from theology, it's not from aesthetics, and it's not from market research that this comes. So let's take up each one of those for a minute. Not from history. Back when I went to seminary, there were very few Lutheran seminaries that even taught courses in worship. And when you did have a course in worship back in my day, and I graduated, you see, in 56, so I'm an old timer. But when I went to seminary, there were very few seminaries. Mine was one of them, Philadelphia. We had George Seltzer and Luther Dodderer Reed. And the Missouri Synod, of course, had Walter Buzin and Peepcorn and those people. But anyhow, worship in those days was taught, you might say, from a historical standpoint. What was the Sarum rite? What was the Mozarabic rite? You know, that kind of thing. You learned the history of these things. And that's still a live field of study, and there are still scholars who devote themselves to it. But it's not where all the excitement is. The excitement is with phenomenology. We'll come back to that in a minute. It's not also from theology. Again, I think this is what Cardinal Ratzinger wants over in the Vatican. He says, now, when we have the Mass, this is what it means theologically. And again, that's important, and there's a big field of study there that a lot of people are devoting their lives to. But that's not where the action is or where the excitement is. Not that the action or the excitement is the important thing, but it's what gave rise to this document and what gave rise to the consensus I'm describing. Not from aesthetics. Again, Luther Reed, I knew Luther Reed only for a brief time before he died at the age of 96 or whatever, but he was a friend of my grandfather, and he was, I don't want to call him an aesthete, but I mean he loved the finer things in life. And he took it as his responsibility to introduce all us country boy seminarians to the finer things in life. Good architecture, good music, good all of those arts, for instance. You know, and I would argue that we're living in an age when people are sensitive to those things, aesthetics. And what's the difference between good architecture and bad architecture, or between good poetry and bad poetry? Well, there are people out there in the pew who know. So the church leaders, including the pastors and the musicians and so on, they should not be insensitive to that stuff. That's all very important. And for whatever it's worth, I found my vocation here 5 years after I was ordained. I was already a pastor. I was already preaching and administering the sacraments and serving as a pastor for 5 years. And my dad was a pastor. But in all that time, it did not occur to me, as it did finally under the influence of Henry Horn, whom some of you may remember, and some others, Christopher Stendahl and so on, and church architecture and other kinds of architecture as well. All of those arts were of great interest to me, and they still are. And it occurred to me 5 years after I was ordained that the place where all those arts, architecture and poetry and music and drama and all that, converge with Christian faith, the place where they converge is Sunday morning at 11 o'clock. Because you see, you're dealing with this architectural space, if not this space, some other. You're dealing with these texts, these hymns, these prayers. You see what I'm saying? So that turned me on when I discovered that. And that gave me a vocation, and I started to write books about it and make speeches about it. And here I am at Holden Village making more speeches about it. So it's still exciting to me. And we're going to get into the nitty-gritty of architecture and drama, the dramatic aspects, that is to say, of worship, poetry and texts and music and so on. We'll get into that this week a little later as well. So it's not from history, it's not from theology, it's not from aesthetics, it's not from market research. And here's where the entertainment evangelism people go. And here is where church growth people go. They go and they look at, I mean, they take as their model the free enterprise system, and they say, what's the target? What's the market we want to go after? The baby boomers. Okay, let's design a church and let's design worship to meet the needs of the baby boomers. And the baby boomers don't want to participate, they want to be an audience. So we'll put on a show for them and we'll call it worship. We'll have a couple of prayers maybe and read a little bit of the Bible. But boomers are used to, and that's what baby boomers want. Now that's market research, and they go after very specific segments of the population. And if you go after this segment, you don't go over and go after any other segment. I mean, it's kind of like apartheid in my view. I mean, separate but equal. You know, you have a black church for the blacks, but don't expect any whites to go to it. You have a baby boomer church for the baby boomers, but don't expect any old people or any little kids. I got problems with that. You know, theological problems. But that's what market research leads you to, and that's what has made Robert Schuller successful. And, you know, boy, it draws the crowds. There's no question about that. There are a lot of people coming into the door of churches like that. But I'm wondering if it's really the church. Martin Marty, I have a quote here from Martin Marty. He says, to try to design a service, a church service, to meet the specific needs of baby boomers, let's say, is to allow those who know the least about faith to determine the most about it. I kind of like that. And I have some problems with that, needless to say. Finally, let me say this about where this ecumenical consensus comes from. It has, well, every period in church history, I suppose, has its favorite era that it looks back to. I call this the era of emulation. These days, what is the time that represents the good old days for you? That's the question I'm asking. You may have heard of the Oxford movement back in the beginning of the century, lasting up until 1930s, 1940s. Again, Luther Reed and George Seltzer and Peepcorn and some of those people were very fond of this Oxford movement that began in England, and it saw the 12th century as the age of faith, building these beautiful cathedrals over in Europe. And the 12th century was their era of emulation. They wanted to make the 20th century faith life look like 12th century faith life. So they built all over the landscape churches that look like little Gothic cathedrals. Divided choir, east wall, altar, rude screen even. I mean, you know what I'm talking about, some of you? Anyhow, our landscapes are full of those kind of churches, right? and they were all designed with this Oxford Movement vision that a good church ought to look like a 12th century church. Gothic. Now, Lutherans never bought into that in great numbers, as I say, Luther Reed did and a few others, but more likely the era of emulation for Lutherans would be the 16th century, Martin Luther, and maybe even the 17th, the Lutheran Orthodoxists, and this hymn that we sang a minute ago smells to me of 17th century Lutheran Orthodoxy, but that's okay. I mean, that's part of our history. We don't have to deny it. But Lutherans would say, well, the real great age was the age of Martin Luther and those early reformers. And what we want to do in the 20th century is make 20th century worship look like Luther's. Again, it's a job for historians, and I wouldn't knock it, but I would say the era of emulation for the new ecumenical consensus that is in this book is not the 13th century, it's not the 16th century. Are you ready for this? It's the 4th century. Just before the age of Constantine. Because, if you remember your church history or your history of the world, Christianity was a persecuted sect for 3 centuries. And then along came Constantine. He was converted to Christianity, won a great big battle after his conversion, so he had, shall we say, a vested interest. He became a Christian, and he had Christianity not only legalized, but the religion of the empire. And from that moment on, you see, from the late 4th century, 5th century, Christianity had privilege and power and prestige that it did not have before. Before it had persecution. Now all of a sudden with Constantine, you've got privilege and power and prestige and money. Now, say the people who wrote this document, that age is coming to a close. The age of Constantine ended last Thursday. I mean, I'm joking, but it lasted well into this century, but it is essentially over. And so we are finding that the biggest mission field for the Christian gospel is, guess where? Africa, India, Indonesia, North America. And are some of you old-timers here know Carol Hinderly, who was the first director of Holden Village? He used to say, we came back here in the old days. 1970 was the first year that we were at Holden Village. And Carol Hinderly said at that time that the Pacific Northwest, Oregon and Washington, are the most secular states in the Union. And he had the statistics to prove it. You'd endorse that?
Still are.
I mean, we're living in a secular world. We can't really say this is, quote-unquote, a Christian nation anymore. Now, sure, it's instructed and it has this long history in the tradition of Western Europe and Western Christianity and so on, but it's a very secular world we're living in. And the people who prepared this book and who buy into this ecumenical consensus, those people are saying the age of Constantine is over. And we are more like the church of the first 3 centuries. Not necessarily persecuted and fed to the lions, although that happens too in some places in the world today. I'm thinking of El Salvador and Oscar Romero, you know, the bishop who was gunned down while he was saying Mass. You know, so you can still pay a price for being a Christian in some parts of the world. But maybe indifference. You know, oh, Jesus, yeah, I know about Jesus. And, you know, they don't really know about Jesus. So North America is a rich mission field in a way that it hasn't been for a long, long time. Western Europe is even more secularized. And the biggest growth these days in missions is, you're not surprised, I'm sure, Africa, Indonesia, places like that. Well, I thought that was helpful to know about the era of emulation, that it's not the 12th century for us today, it's not the 16th century, it's more like the 4th century. Now, my title could well have appeared in quotation marks, because this is a direct quote from a friend of mine. Bill Charlesworth is an old buddy from college, and he is a Roman Catholic background. And as I say, we graduated from college, my goodness, 1948. And he's been a pious and faithful Christian. Along came Pope John the 23rd, 1960. Everybody expected Pope John would be a kind of caretaker. I mean, he was an old man when he was elected pope. Nobody expected much of him. They just wanted him to keep the wheels going until they could elect the pope they really wanted. Well, did he surprise everybody. He called the Second Vatican Council, and out of the Second Vatican Council came all of this stuff I'm telling you about. And he let the scholars and the experts in on, he wanted to open the windows of the Vatican. He wanted to make the church a contemporary voice in the modern world. He was a wonderful pope. He was our pope. John the 23rd was a wonderful pope. And incidentally, he's in our commemorations here in the Green Book. You're aware of that? June the 3rd, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, John the 23rd, Bishop of Rome. Died in 1963. He was only pope for 3 years, but he started the wheels of the Second Vatican Council. He never saw it finished, but he saw it underway, and he is the guy, more than anybody else, who was responsible for bringing not just the Roman Catholic Church, but the rest of us too, into the 20th century. And Bill Charlesworth, my friend from college, 20 years now, 15 years anyhow, he was puzzled by all of this. And I can remember a conversation with him. We would keep in touch and see him in the summer. He lived far away. But we would keep in touch, and I can hear him saying, "Paul, where are the invariables? Is everything up for grabs?" He saw the altar coming out from the wall. He saw the Mass now in English instead of in Latin. He saw the priest actually preaching a sermon and being pastoral to people. I mean, that was all unfamiliar to him as a Roman Catholic. And he said, "Where are the invariables?" I don't think I would put it that way. I would say, "Where are the essentials? Is there a core, in other words, at Christian worship, at the heart of Christian worship, that we ought to pay attention to? Is there something there that we do not want to throw out?" And there were a lot of Roman Catholics, particularly, can you imagine what it must have been like back in 1963? 1964, to be a Roman Catholic, and all of a sudden, your Mass is not in Latin anymore. All of a sudden, the priest is facing the people across the altar. I mean, lots of major changes there. And again, inviting you to rethink your piety, inviting you to challenge, you know, to understand anew your relationship to God and your relationship to one another and your relationship to the creation. So, Bill asked that question, where are the invariables? And I would say, well, there are some. There are some essentials, and we'll get to them. I would say, first of all, though, what are our standards for picking out what those invariables are? Or the essentials? How do we find out what the essentials are? Well, I'm going to suggest, and then when I say this, I think I'll hang it up and let you throw questions at me. I would say there are six. And I put this in a book long ago. In time. Biblical, Catholic, confessional, let's even say national, let's say parochial. Word parochial is parochial. It means related to the parish, and then ultimately personal. It has to make sense for me. Martin Luther made a big thing of those two words in the communion, given and shed for you. Okay. I would say these are our standards, and this is how we find out what those invariables are, what the standards are. again, feel free to interrupt me, but when I come to the end of this, we'll be pretty much near the end of my presentation, and we'll have some general conversation. First of all, our worship ought to be biblical worship. You will agree with me. It's based on the Bible. The Bible is our standard. And that means there's right away some things ruled out, and there's some things included. The religion of Israel, for instance. If you read the Psalms, you can see that the religion of Israel included trumpets and cymbals and harps and stringed instruments and even liturgical dance and incense. I mean, all of that was part of the worship of Israel. But it also paid attention to the poor and the widows and those who needed justice. So right away, if our worship is to be biblical, we should never cut the line that connects cult and code here on this list here. We should never cut the line that goes between cult and creed either, for that matter, but I'm here to tell you right now that the fact that our worship ought to be biblical means that there is always an ethical component to our worship. And the part of the meaning of the offering on Sunday morning is that you are presenting your life represented in that bread and in that wine and in that money, and you are saying, look, God, rescue this and use me as an agent in that rescue. And a portion of that, you see, was set aside in the ancient church, the 4th century church. A portion of those gifts were set aside for the poor and the widows. And today, a portion of your offering ought to go to the poor and the widows and the work of the larger church and so on. So what I'm saying is biblical worship is worship that keeps the connection between liturgy and ethics, behavior, how you live in the world, and whether there's justice, and whether there's peace, and whether there is the reign of God, shalom, wonderful word, the peace of God. Biblical. The fact that our worship is biblical, too, has made a big difference in, for instance, the understanding of the Holy Communion. Jesus is a Jew at the Last Supper. He's gathered his disciples shortly before he's going to die, and he can see the handwriting on the wall. I don't think he's, you know, reading people's minds, but he can see what's ahead, and he knows it's going to mean suffering for him. And he gathers his disciples at a holy meal. And he breaks the bread and he pours out the cup and he says, this is my body. And he says, I would even say, this is my body. You people. And Jesus is doing a very Jewish thing. He's praying over the bread and the cup, a berakah. Have you heard that word before? That's a nice word to know. It's a type of Jewish prayer. B-E-R is most often the vowels are berakah. And a berakah is a type of prayer that goes like this. Blessed are you, O Lord our God, maker of all things. You bring forth bread from the earth. That's a berakah. To this day, as I understand it, every male Jew has to pray 100 berakoth every day. And they're short little prayers. Blessed are you, O Lord our God, maker of all things. You bring forth bread from the earth. The offertory prayer in our green book is a berakah, essentially. Remember how the assisting minister says, blessed are you, O Lord our God, maker of all things. Through your goodness, you have blessed us with these gifts. With them, we offer ourselves to your service and dedicate our lives, etc., etc. Remember those words? Okay, that's a berakah. And the neat thing about a berakah is, particularly in the public worship of the Jews and in a public setting like the Last Supper, the leader prays that prayer expecting that other people are listening in. So it is at once, you might say, sacrament and sacrifice. It's a prayer addressed to God, yes, but it's also proclamation to the people gathered there. So we should not be embarrassed, for instance, that our Holy Communion goes on and the minister prays a prayer, Holy God, mighty Lord, endless is your mercy and eternal your reign, you have filled all creation, etc., etc. That's essentially a berakah, a prayer of praise to God. My dad used to be a little puzzled by this. You know, what are we doing telling God what he already knows? Well, that's Jewish.
That's the way Jews do it. Jesus is a Jew. And we're mixing up sacrament and sacrifice in a way that the Jews would do it. And when you come to that realization that we're Jews, basically, Christians are a kind of Jew, you might say, cousins at least of Jews. When you come to that realization, all of the old arguments about transubstantiation and consubstantiation and all that kind of stuff goes out the window. And Roman Catholics these days don't use those words. They realize it's a very Jewish thing that Jesus is doing. And Lutherans and all these other denominations that I read to you, they're agreeing. So we don't fight anymore about those things that used to divide us, you see? That's why I say this is an unprecedented agreement since before the Reformation. Now, there's still some things we fight about, and there are still people who don't agree with this, as I have said. But basically, we're living in a new age, and it's a wonderful new age. Incidentally, for whatever it's worth, it's a golden age of hymnody. Wonderful new hymns, which is why we have this, you know, we have several hymn books, not just this over there in the village center. We got a lot of new hymn books and new hymns. And whenever that happens, you know, there's always going to be some stuff that's not so hot that probably won't stand the test of time, but there's other stuff that's great that will stand the test of time. And we are living in a golden age of hymnody. Well, that's biblical. You could find other implications as well, but I won't go into that. Let me go into Catholic. I use that word with quotation marks. I mean it small c. Not Roman Catholic, but small c Catholic, ecumenical, Trinitarian, universal, Christian, non-sectarian. All of those words mean the same to me, essentially the same. And the word Catholic is a perfectly good word. We should never lose it. We should never give it over to any other church. We are Catholics. We are Lutheran Catholics. And your Methodist friend is a Methodist Catholic. And your Catholic friend is a Roman Catholic, most likely. And that's a denomination fully as much as Lutheran or Presbyterian. Your Presbyterian friends are Presbyterian Catholic. And that word Catholic, as I say, is a good word. And it's not translated by the word Christian. In the Creed, when you say the Holy Christian Church, that's not quite the same. The Holy Catholic Church is important to have that word Catholic there. Because Catholic means it does not lack any part. It has everything it needs. And that's a wonderful word. What might it mean that our worship is to be Catholic, ecumenical, Trinitarian, non-sectarian, whole, complete, lacking nothing? Well, for 16 centuries, I used to give this test to my students in class. Here's a timeline. I'll go right through my drawing here. Here's the time of Jesus. Here's 1995. Here would be, well, about the year 1000. Here would be about the year 500. Here's the era of emulation, about the year, let's say 300 even. Anyhow, you can divide the whole timeline up. But let's face it, friends, the Reformation happens about here, right? And the Baptists and the Methodists come in about here. For hundreds and hundreds of years. Pardon me. For hundreds and hundreds of years, the Christian Church has had word and sacrament as its chief worship every Sunday. Now, what does that mean for those of us who don't have communion every Sunday as the chief service? It means, in my view, we have some homework. And we should be reclaiming the communion so that a standard operating procedure every Sunday, because that's the Catholic consensus. For 500 years, 600 years, and even beyond that, Martin Luther assumed that it would be communion every Sunday. John Calvin assumed it would be communion every Sunday. John Wesley, are you ready for this? John Wesley was an Anglican priest who had communion 4 or 5 times a week. So all of our founders, you might say, Presbyterian, Methodist, Lutheran, whatever, all of our founders simply assumed word and sacrament. And we fell away from it in 1700, 1800 with the Enlightenment and historical accidents, the frontier when there weren't very many, over here in North America, when there weren't very many pastors, stuff like that. There are historical reasons why we have not had the communion, the Holy Communion, as chief service. But now we're reclaiming it. And all the churches are reclaiming it. And this document here urges all the churches to reclaim Holy Communion every Sunday. The new Presbyterian hymn book looks just like our hymn book. It says the communion is appropriate as often as every Lord's Day. The new Methodist hymn book says the same thing. Now, you can find Methodist churches, parishes, Presbyterian churches, parishes, that don't have it every Sunday. You can find Lutheran churches that don't have it every Sunday. But I would argue, and this book is arguing, challenging your piety again, that we ought to move in the direction of communion every Sunday. Because that's the Catholic consensus. Confessional, that's the flavor in the soup. We don't have to be apologetic about being Lutheran. We got a great tradition. I like to think of the confessional level here, level number 3, as offering flavor in the soup, the ecumenical soup. What have Lutherans got that's great? Well, we got Johann Sebastian Bach, among other things. We got these wonderful German chorales of which we sang one a few minutes ago. We got this congregational gift in North America. Now we're moving to national. Are you aware of this? The Lutheran churches in North America are the only churches in Christendom that sing the ordinary of the service every Sunday. By the ordinary of the service, I mean glory to God in the highest, or this is the feast, or holy, holy, holy Lord God Almighty. Those things that the congregation sings every Sunday. And that is the only, we are the only church, the churches that use this book, and Missouri Synod too with their book, we are the only churches in Christendom. The churches in Germany, the Lutheran churches in Germany don't do that, as a rule, if you've been to Germany. Scandinavia, same thing. Roman Catholic in this country, Episcopal in this country, they're having the dickens of a time trying to get their people to sing what Lutherans have been singing in this continent, anyhow, for generations. Now, we don't do it very well. I mean, you know, we have homework to do there, too. But, I mean, that's a wonderful gift. We've moved from the confessional to the national. You know, the Lutheran Church in North America is different from the Lutheran Church in Germany. Praise the Lord. They've got terrible problems over there. And it's different from the Lutheran Church in Norway or Sweden. They got their problems too. We got our problems, but they're ours, right? National, parochial, it would be very unwise, I think, of a pastor to come in and throw over the apple cart and say, this is the way it's going to be from now on. You know, we have to take account of parish history and the parish traditions and lead people along pastorally, gently, with the persuasion of the Spirit. Well, I want to quit. Let me just flag for you what I want to, and personal, of course, the personal level, as Luther says, if it doesn't make sense to you, if you don't see it for me, for each individual, then there's something wrong. You know this wonderful play, Death of a Salesman, Willie Loman, Arthur Miller. At the end of that play, the salesman has died, and his wife says, you know, his whole life was a failure in some sense. And he felt that he himself was a failure. But she says of him, of Willie, her husband, even there, attention must be paid. Wow. That moved me. Every human life is important, and it has to get to the personal level. Okay, let me flag what I'm going to do. The next couple of days, I'm going to say, for instance, in the next couple of days, that the ecumenical consensus sees worship as a participatory thing. It's not a performance. And we're going to talk about entertainment evangelism more specifically tomorrow. It is inclusive, Catholic, small c again, in the best sense of the word. It is sacramental and incarnational. And it wants to enlarge the sign. It wants to deal with primary experience. It is suspicious of technology, or at least it wants to put technology in its proper places. So we'll talk about all of those things in the times to come. Let me throw the floor open for questions right now, or comments. Don't be shy. Go ahead.
I'm shy. The one word that comes, and I suppose it may be addressing tomorrow, is the word contemporary. I mean, I think you probably have it at the level of personal, but, you know, I think one of the things we've kind of ignored is passage of time. This is a good hymn. The text is what's good here. Whether they can sing or not, that's the organist.
Yeah, right.
And I think that we've been so enamored of this biblical text and of the structure that's been centuries long that people don't see that there's something that's contemporary.
Good point. The Spirit is always speaking to us, and the Spirit speaks
critically sometimes.
What's that?
Even critically.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And what does the psalm say? Psalm says, sing unto the Lord a new song. Doesn't mean you have to stop singing the old songs, but let's sing the new songs. And if we don't sing the new songs, you're suggesting to me, if we do not sing the new songs, then we're being unfaithful. We have to sing it in our language, in our thought forms, in our architectural forms, in our, you know, all of the arts, the contemporary arts, it seems to me, ought to be put into the service of the gospel. And that means, of course, being contemporary. We can be faithful to all of this tradition. This is the tradition that I'm laying on you. Write this down. This is going to be on the test. Tradition is a way of giving your grandfather and your grandmother a vote in the decisions that you must make today. Isn't that nice? Transgenerational democracy. So we don't ever want to poo-poo tradition. Tradition is very important. However, that's not the whole story. We have to speak in contemporary terms too. We have to be relevant as well as reverent. We have to use present-day forms. And, oh, boy, there's some exciting stuff. There's even some exciting modern stuff in this book, believe it or not. But the stuff, too, that's in the With One Voice, marvelous. Some of that Tezeh hymn, we'll sing some of that, too, as the week goes by. Something else. Go ahead.
I would argue that all true worship is contemporary.
Excellent.
I mean, we're not worshiping in the 16th century.
Yeah.
I don't know any church. Maybe there is. I don't know. Is there a church that's doing 16th century German?
Say that again. No, may,
I don't know any church that's doing 16th century German worship.
Yeah.
If we're worshiping now, it's contemporary. Mm-hmm. It might not be relevant all the time.
Yeah. It's a fine line. I think we want to honor the past. That's the whole point of my definition of tradition, that we want to honor what Grandpa and Grandma have to give us. And we don't want to assume that everything that's new is good and everything that's old is bad. But we don't want to assume the reverse either. We don't want to assume that everything old is bad and everything new is good. You know, the other way around. Anyhow, you know what I'm trying to say. There's good and there's bad in the tradition. There's good and there's bad in what's new. And what does Jesus say? The householder takes out from his treasure what is old and what is new, and we have them both.
But we try to be intentional about not using that word contemporary. When we do an informal worship, we call it informal.
Yeah.
But if we use LBW, that's more contemporary, I think. I think that LBW can't.
Yeah, I think I'd be willing to fight with you about that. I think this is contemporary, or it can be made contemporary. I think it could even be made informal.
Yeah.
In other words, just to have this book in your hand does not mean you have to be standoffish or cold.